Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Very happy to be here at Dhammapala. It's been about 10 years since I last visited. So these last few days I've been able to take in the spirit of the place once more, and the landscape around, being able to visit different places, going up to the Jungfrau Joch yesterday and up to a high valley nearby Kandersteg today. As we were coming down from the high valley, I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it's a one-way road that goes up and down to the valley. And the local system is such that there's a certain amount of time when people are allowed to go up, and then certain amounts of time when people are allowed to go down, and that switches back and forth. And people should know the time. The correct time to set off and when they're able to go up or able to go down. So we were setting off in our vehicle from the top, and the road seemed to be quite empty, and we set off 1 or 2 minutes early from the allotted time to head down. And as we headed down, we saw another vehicle is coming up and approaching the little stone bridge at the top. So we pulled off to one side and crept into the corner, and this vehicle with a trailer on the back crept round, and the person driving wound down the window and demonstrated their negative feelings quite clearly to us, and upset, and like saying, "It's only 4 minutes past, you're early." And so we thought, "Oh, well, thank you for pointing that out. Our apologies. We're out of the way." And then the next one right behind did the same thing. Stopped on the corner, was even a bit more red-faced and indignant and upset. So we were thinking, "Oh dear, well, we've overstepped the mark here," and stayed where we were. And thought, "Well, we better wait. It's now past 5 past, so we're legally allowed to go down. It's our period of time, but let's just wait a bit longer." Our trusty driver was very patient, and so we waited, and sure enough, another vehicle came up. Even though it was a going down time, there were some vehicles still coming up. We waited on the corner, and the person was so happy to see that we were very kindly letting them go past and have the road, even though it was not their allotted time. So it was all smiles and thumbs up. And so then we asked, "So are there any more vehicles behind you?" So, "Oh yes, yeah, there's at least one more vehicle behind." So we waited and waited a bit longer. And then sure enough, another vehicle came up, and this person again was very friendly and "Thank you so much for waiting," and got into a little bit of a conversation. She said, I couldn't understand the language very well, but there was something to do with goats. And then by way of illustrating her point, she had a little kid, literally a kid, a baby goat. She sort of picked it up from the seat beside her. "This one is 1 day old." So, very happy to wait for this lady who's looking after the goats. And she said, "And my daughter's coming in another vehicle behind with a trailer. They've got to go very slowly because they've got a trailer full of goats. And so we go, "Okay, we can wait." Sat there in the corner. And then the last vehicle with the trailer full of goats, the mother goat and the other two sibling goats that were just freshly born. So as we were thinking about this, it's like, wow, the first couple of people were really angry and indignant and upset. The third one was warmly appreciative, and then after that, extremely grateful. And the different expressions on people's faces, the different mood and tone of the exchange. And so it reminded us of how we live in different worlds, and the world that we inhabit is very much of our own creation. And I was reminded of a story I was told, very similar situation where when I was living in America, I went up to give some talks at a Zen center in Oregon. It was called Larch Mountain Zen Center at that time. And it's on the Columbia Gorge. And in the summertime, it gets very, very hot on that part of Oregon. And the teacher of the Zen Center, Chozen Bays, is a very, very smart, creative teacher. And she was telling us how they just had a Zen session for the previous week before I got there. And it was really, really hot. So about 40 degrees Celsius, about 105, 108 Fahrenheit. So it was really cooking hot. And their Zendo was a former farm building, and a round-topped converted farm shed. And so it was really hot inside. And so Chozen and her husband, Hogen, were trying to think, how can we cool this place down? And then Chozen had the idea, sprinklers. Let's put the sprinklers over the roof. So they got the sprinkling system, draped the sprinkler pipes over the roof, and then turned the water on. So then they had the sound of falling water and trickling down the roof, and the evaporating water cooled down the Zendo. So she was thinking, great, that's many degrees cooler. This is success. Well, yeah. And so she was feeling pleased with how things had turned out. The reason why she told me this story was that, so after they turned the sprinklers on and had this sort of impromptu cooling system, they're in the interviews, they have these formal short interviews called dokusan. So later that day, she said there was a series of interviews she had. So the first one that came in that said in the it's like a formalized exchange between the people, between the teacher and the student. And the first person came in and said, "I understand. The message is in the water. This is the answer. I have received the teaching." And okay, Satu. Then the next one came in and said, "I'm really upset. You know, this is, I'm sure you're contravening the local laws about water usage. We have very tight restrictions here in the gorge in the summertime. And I'm really not happy about this. I know this is a formal interview, but I just have to say, I'm concerned." The next one came in and said, "Well, actually, I'm an engineer, and I've been calculating the amount of water that we would need to spread over the roof, and the square footage of the roof, and the rate of fall of the water. We can actually reduce by another several degrees." Yeah, and then the next one was, "Thank you so much. Thank you. I was cooking in there. You're so wise. You're so helpful. You're so practical. You're the greatest teacher." And I think that, I forget the details, I'm just trying to remember this from more than 20 years ago, but I think the fifth one was, "I'm not sure who's giving the meditation instruction during the Zazen periods. Doesn't sound like your voice or Hogen, but it's been very helpful advice I've been getting that's been delivered during the sittings." And it became clear that they'd been turning the sound of the falling water into meditation instruction. So this I remember that from, and I've mentioned it in a few talks since, how it illustrates how we live in such different worlds, and that this is a core teaching of the Buddha at the that at the heart of things, none of us experiences the world, but each of us experiences our mind's version of the world. So, and when he was, there was a well-known dialogue between the Buddha and a devata that came to visit. Deva by the name of Rohitasa. One night, this deva, this angelic being, appeared and said to the Buddha, in my previous life as a human being, I was a yogi, I was a meditator, and I developed great powers. And I made this resolution that I would walk through the land, through the sky, until I reached the end of the world. But even though I walked for my whole life and I died on the journey, I never reached the end of the world in my long, long walk. And the Buddha said to Rohitasa, you cannot reach the end of the world by walking, but I tell you, if you don't reach the end of the world, you won't reach the end of suffering. A puzzle or a conundrum that Rohitasa didn't quite understand at first. And then the Buddha went on to explain, it's in this very body, this 2 meter long body with its thoughts and its perceptions, there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. And then in another related teaching, he went on to explain, what is the world in this Dhamma and discipline? What do we mean by that word, the world, loka? And he said, that whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is what is called the world in this Dhamma and discipline. And what is it whereby one is a perceiver and a conceiver of the world? The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. That is the means whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world. So this means, to put it into more simple English, and I presume, I hope everyone can understand my English well enough, that each of us experiences our mind's representation of the world, put together from what we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, our language, our thoughts, our life experiences. We assemble a best guess of what's happening around us. And so this has, I feel this is a very important teaching. It's somewhat, I would say, related to the phenomenological the perspective that you have in European philosophy. But what is significant about it is that it is a great cause for compassion and sympathy, understanding between people. Because if I think that, if I believe that what I experience is the world, and my mind is giving a completely accurate and reliable perception of exactly how the world is, if that isn't the same as yours, then I presume that you're wrong, or you're deluded, and the mind then creates division and alienation, separation between ourselves and others. If, however, we appreciate, well, what I'm experiencing is my mind's version of the world, put together because of the language I speak, or my life experiences, or the age that I'm born in, the livelihood I've chosen, and so on, then it's necessarily going to be the case that my version of the world is going to be a bit different from yours. It can't possibly be exactly the same, just where we're sitting in the room or where people are joining online from different places. Our perspectives are different. That those who are online are just seeing all of this happening on a little screen. The people who are here at Dhammapada are seeing the back of a laptop in front of me and the other Sangha members here in the shrine room and the Buddha Rupa and so on. So just physically right now, the perspective we each have is different, just through the world of vision. So the more that we can appreciate that our mind is just creating a version of the world, then we make more space for each other. We make we naturally recognize, well, of course, somebody else's experiences, their perspective, their thoughts, their feelings, they're going to be different from what's felt and what's known here. And so that capacity to make space for each other, to receive other people's perspectives, other people's opinions, other people's priorities, is a basis for sympathy, a basis for harmony and concord between us and others. So I feel it's a very significant teaching to recognize that, you know, what we don't assume that just because we think something, it's an absolute truth. but rather do you take the principle, and just because you think it, it doesn't mean it's true. It's a thought. It's what I like to call it, a convenient fiction. It's a useful description, like calling today Saturday or Samstag. Sorry. or the Switzerland version of that, Samedi in French. So what's the right word for today? You know, we have different conventions, different languages. And the more that we can appreciate this, then the direct result of that is a greater capacity to make space for others and a greater quality of peace and concord in our lives. Well, that change of view, it doesn't just happen on its own, I would suggest. But it takes work or effort, A, to recognize the habits that we have already of how the mind sees the world and how we attach to our opinions, our points, our point of view, and our version of history of our life or of the world. It takes effort to recognize the habits that are already formed, the conditioning that is present. And also then it takes effort to let go of those, to change the view, to change the perspective. So one of the things that I like to talk about and I feel is, again, a very significant element of Buddhist practice is the way in which effort is best made. Oftentimes, particularly in the Western world, but I think it's pretty global now, it's taken that any kind of effort, any kind of doing is stressful. We say, oh, I'm looking forward to the weekend, I'm looking forward to the retreat, I'm looking forward to retirement. But I don't have to do this thing. I like to point out that even with meditation, when the bell goes at the end of the meditation, there's a, I'm not reading anybody's mind, but this is very commonly the case, there's a, thank goodness that's over. Because even though it might be that your knees are needing to be moved or there's some aches and pains in the body, just the very fact of me doing the meditation is the way the mind holds it. It can be kind of stressful and burdensome. And just the ding, there's a thing I don't have to be doing, therefore relief. So I would say that's a symptom of a much broader malaise or sort of societal problem or issue, whereby any kind of doing, any kind of effort, any kind of working is taken to be stressful or burdensome. And you find in the world of spiritual development that number of teachings that say suggest you don't make any effort, don't do anything, be awake to the way things are, and then enlightenment is present. And there's a certain truth to that, but I feel it's also misunderstanding the Buddha's teaching, and in particular how effort and direction can be given in a skillful way. Yeah, there are very popular books like Krishnamurti's famous teaching on the truth is a pathless land, or books like Journey Without a Goal, and these kind of teachings that are very commonly found in the spiritual domain, whether it's from Buddhist or Hindu or Taoist or different kinds of background. So I feel that it's good to consider the Buddha talked about a path, magga. The fourth noble truth is the eightfold path. A path indicates going from one place to another. There's a direction and there's a goal. I think people avoid that idea of a path and a goal, and that sense of direction because of dualistic kind of quality that might bring, and the sense ambition or the way the mind can attach to goal directedness, it can be very stressful and burdensome. But I feel that if we look at the Buddha's teaching, that in the Eightfold Path, Sama Sankalpa, the second element, which is translated as right resolution or right intention, right thought, right aspiration, that's about directionality. So there has to be a way that we can give direction to our lives, our thoughts, our words. There has to be a way that that can be given that's totally peaceful, that is, otherwise it couldn't be an element of the Eightfold Path. It couldn't be part of that, those principles. Similarly, samavayamo, right effort, or effort which is in tune with reality. The very fact that effort is there in this prescription for skillful practice by the Buddha means there must be a way that effort can be made that is completely peaceful and completely in accord with reality, with Dhamma, so that direction can be given and effort can be made that is not stressful, that is not burdensome, that is not, and doesn't bring any kind of tension in the heart. So I feel that it's not the issue of direction and decision making, or it's not the aspect of making effort that are problematic, but it's how the sense of self gets gathered around those qualities. I'm choosing. I want to get there. I've got to head in that direction, so I will get to a good place. I need to get from here to there, so that if effort is and that kind of directionality is based on self-view and on I making and mind making mind, then it will be stressful. But it will indeed be something that the heart is looking for relief from. But if it takes some mindfulness and attention. If the habits of self view, of self creating, self centered thinking are dropped, then direction can be given and the effort can be made that is completely stress-free. There's still effort, and there's still a direction being given towards what is peaceful, what is liberating, what is beneficial. But the driving force, that which is, say, the fuel or the guiding spirit for that direction and that and the effort, is mindfulness and wisdom rather than self-view, rather than me trying to get something so I will be better. For many, many years, Ajahn Sumedho would emphasize how if we create a framework of I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future, so that's an unhelpful paradigm. So we need to change the paradigm from... And I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, hearing him say this, and a few of us were there. I think Ajahn Kema Siri, probably there at Amaravati, hearing Lumpur saying this. And you think, but I am an unenlightened person. I have got to do something. I do want to be enlightened in the future. Bodhinanda was probably there as well. But, so you think, well, what's he talking about? And slowly, the penny or the finnick or the euro dropped. After I had to hear it many, many, many times before I really understood that it's the way that the mind is casting it in terms of self-view. I am an unenlightened person. That's what I am. And I've got to do something now so I will become an enlightened person in the future. So he would say, rather than following that paradigm based on self-view, then there needs to be a paradigm shift to be awake now. Not me being awake now, but this trusting in that quality of wakeful awareness that is accessible here and now, and applying that wakeful aware quality to the present experience. And I do confess quite readily, as I just mentioned, I had to hear it many dozens, probably hundreds of times before the finnick dropped. And oh yes, I think. I'm getting the point. So it's not something that's easy to pick up the full sense of it in the space of an evening or one little Dhamma talk for half an hour. But I do feel it's an extraordinarily helpful principle, and that to see that what seems quite straightforward or practical on an ordinary day-to-day level, you know, I am Ajahn Amaro, this is Ajahn Abhinanda, you know, that's Tanmanunyo, and this is Dhammapala, you know, it's Saturday. These conventional truths are not the whole truths. So the conventional truth that I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to be, in order to become enlightened in the future, yes, that has a certain validity in the level of conventional truth, but it's not ultimately true, ultimately real. So the encouragement that Ajahn Sumedho was giving, and I feel is extraordinarily helpful, is again letting go of the habit of casting the practice and the spiritual aspiration into the framework of self-view, to let go of that eye-making and mind-making habit, and instead to, as you would say, trust in awareness, trust in that wakeful, aware quality that's always accessible to us. And in the forest tradition, this is what we refer to as being the actual Buddha refuge. When we say Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, I take refuge in the Buddha, essentially, that's that there is the choice to be awake. That's what Buddhang Saranam Gacchami is referring to in its essence, at its heart, is there is the capacity to be awake, wake up. And with that wakefulness, then that is the guiding spirit, the guiding force for our lives. So out of that wakefulness, mindfulness is a mindful attunement to the time, the place, the situation. And what needs to be done can be done. What needs to be left alone can be left alone. I see that the clock has gone round to 8:30 here in Dhammapala, so I'll offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.
Namayang Namavada Katha Sadhu Karang Dhamma Sing Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu. So we do have some time for questions. Anybody here? Or if anybody who's joined us via Zoom, I think probably the easiest if they just speak, or you can see from them, because of the whole people. If somebody wants to ask a question, you can probably notice on the screen.
So please feel free if there's any questions come to mind. There was a fair amount packed into that half hour, but please don't be shy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
I have a question considering these goals, because I feel I have to reach goals all the time with things like when at the moment I have to do like a final, like a work, I don't know in English, like it's like an exam but I'm writing, so
a dissertation.
Yes, and then I'm asked to set the goal first or like mm-hmm. a vision, and I have this feeling, you mentioned something like that before, that I get very stressed because of this cold. I feel like this cold takes away my creativity or like also the freedom to find the way to get there sometimes. And would you say it's not really clear to me how to get present with it? How to really be present by doing this very thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's so, like everything I learn and how it's thought, it's like very, it's just in the mind. And presence for me has not only to do with my mind. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're not alone in that kind of experience. One of the things that I feel is also helpful to appreciate, amongst the many lists that we have in the Pali in the Pali Canon, the Buddhist tradition, one of the lists of four qualities are called the four bases of success, and so the Iddhipada in Pali. And these are four qualities that are needed in order to do anything, a practical task like hosting a Zoom Dhamma talk or completing a dissertation, or it can be something more, you know, very spiritually oriented, like training the mind to be focused and free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Or it can be very unwholesome, like how to rob a bank. You know, whether it's wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral, those four qualities are needed. And so this is, I feel, helpful to understand that in terms of things that are wholesome, you still need the first element is chanda, which is desire. There needs to be interest or zeal is a good English word. Okay, enthusiasm. I'm interested. I want to do this. Like you've signed up for some university course, or yes, I've committed to this. So the chanda is first on that list of those four. There needs to be that interest, but also desire. But it can be completely free of self-view. But and the more that it's free of self-view and any other defilements, then it will be helpful. And then the second one is virya. We need to apply energy. That, okay, you sign up for this course, you're interested to do it, you've got to put energy into it. And then the third one is you need to contemplate how you're going to do it. So that in the four Iddhipada, the word citta is used for that, which is a broader term. In this respect, it means thinking things through. Okay, I want to do this course. How long is it going to take? What do I have to do in order to do this well? And then the fourth one of the four is called vimamsa, which is reviewing. It's like, well, how did that work out? Did I succeed in the task that I undertook? What good and bad effects has it had? I mean, what's the result of having done that? So that's the feedback element of that whole system. So that set of four qualities is essential for any kind of thing that we undertake. And as I was saying, the more that the whole process can be free of greed, hatred, and delusion, then that very effort, that desire and energy and contemplation, that can all be things that lead towards greater clarity and peacefulness. What you're speaking about, I feel, is also very, very related to the strong Western condition. Well, again, it's kind of global now, of how success is taken as an absolute good and failure is taken as an absolute bad. The mind focuses on a particular thing and then it inflates it to be incredibly important. And the more that I've got to succeed, I can't fail, the more of I, me, and mine that's invested in that and particular outcomes, then the further away the mind is from that kind of presence and the more it's in a stress-creating state. So I feel it's extremely helpful to look at success and failure and to contemplate what they are and how they work. And if we look at how the mind relates to that, it's quite revealing how if you cast your mind back at 5 years or 10 years and something that you succeeded at, you got a grant or you got accepted for some course or a job or you got a project that worked very well, and you think, yes, this is great, I'm so happy. And then 5 years later, you realize, oh, that was a terrible mistake. Why was I celebrating? Getting that job was the worst thing that happened. I was so happy at the time. And I'm not reading anybody's mind. It's like, this is how we work. And then similarly, the other end of the scale, when something's gone terribly wrong, we've had some horrible illness, or we've had something that's failed dramatically, and that had a great crisis in the family or in the workplace, or all our money suddenly gone because the bank collapsed, And then at the time it's a disaster and exactly what you wouldn't have wished for. But then again, when you look at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, like, well, I never would have asked for that, but actually a tremendous amount of good came out of that painful situation. And again, it's just how these things work for most people. You know, I obviously I don't know hardly anybody here for your backgrounds, but this is generally the case. So if we reflect on our life and look back in that way, what does that say about success and failure? You know, that the mind can be fixated, I've got to get this dissertation right, I've got to. But it's narrowing down that the view to that one action activity, and nothing else matters. And but if you reflect in this way, like, well, yes, I'm doing my best to get it right, but let's not assume that this is going to make me happy forever. Or this intrinsically has some kind of great value. There could also be all kinds of dukkha, difficulty that comes out of this. When I was living in America, I remember one woman coming to, I think she was on a retreat with me, and she was saying how she'd been part of this little writer's circle. She and a group of friends, like half a dozen people, six or eight people, they would write pieces and then share them with each other, and none of them had ever been published, but they were very keen on creative writing and with poetry and stories and such like, and they had this great little collective together, this sort of group of they're all women writers. And she said it was so good. They had such a good time together. Then I got a book contract. You know, I got signed by this publisher and I got this $100,000 advance. And then none of my friends will talk to me. You know, I'm a kind of a reject from the group. And, I got what I wanted. And rather than it being something that was wonderful, it destroyed put a large obstacle in the way of the friendship. So she was relaying this and how on this retreat she was having to deal with the fallout of, like, I'm glad I got the contract, but I miss my friends. So I feel to look very closely at how the mind relates to success and failure and creates and gives them a more validity, more substantiality than they really deserve. And to say, well, you still do your best, but you also expand the view around that. Think, well, whether I ever use this, I finally got my dissertation in and I've got the qualification, I've got ka-chunk, I'm now doctor this, or put extra letters after my name. So... And then you can hold it a lot more lightly. And it's not so much, say, something that's carried around as a burden. So you still do the best that you can, but it's not something that the mind is inflating or making too much of. I was very, this is an area I've put a lot of time and attention to because I was very success-oriented. As a kid, I was quite successful, and you get a lot of praise for that. So, like in school and on the sports field, I was very successful. So by the time I was in my late teens, I had no clue the degree to which I was obsessed with succeeding and winning and being the best and terrified of failure. And so I carried that into my monastic life. I was trying to be the champion monk, and terrified of not being. And it took years, maybe 5 or 6, 7 years to see that. But when I started to really look at it, I thought, wow, where did this begin? And I thought, when I was about 3, I could read and write when I was 3. And you get a lot of pats, well done. Yeah. And that's good. Everyone's smiling and they love me, And so... the degree to which the mind was conditioned to that, and to consciously let myself not be perfect, or to just fail at a few things, and not to try to be the best at everything all the time, it's a big relief. And I often quote one of the other, when I was looking at this and actively working on that area in my attitude, one of the monks at Amravati said to me, you know, you're much easier to live with since you stopped trying to be perfect. So I didn't know whether to be insulted or relieved. Ajahn Sung were all... So I was very grateful for the comment. That was sort of simultaneously a bit offended, but also, oh, that's good. So that that looking at the attitude around those things, and I used during that time, there was a little phrase I used as a sort of mantra, right? Just do what you do and let the world make of it what it will. If you can understand that. Just do what you do. So you care and you do your best and then leave it alone. And some people will love it. Some people will hate it. Most people won't even notice. So any other thoughts or questions? Any questions also from folks who are remote?
You mentioned the less me and mine would be in this chanda, motivation would be better.
Mm-hmm.
From your experience, what would be the best motivation beyond me and mine to be in this chanda?
Well, it's a good question. I would say that the attunement to the time, the place, the situation, and then trusting in that awareness, letting that attunement be what guides what needs to be done or what doesn't need to be done, what's going to be useful to say or to not say. And that, 'cause even if you have a thought, or what's going to be for the greatest benefit for the most people, that's still a bit dualistic, and also the mind can latch on to a particular plan or a specific mode of action. And I would say, I mean, it is a very good question, but I would say as time goes by, it's more and more just that kind of wordless attunement to the time, the place, the situation, and seeing, letting your actions and your words come from that attunement, and letting, I like to use the phrase a self-adjusting universe, that, you know, you don't have to do anything, just get out of the way. But what's needed is that wakeful awareness that is attuning this life to the living system that it's a part of. And then out of that attunement, then there is the natural responsivity. And if it's appropriate to do something or do something very proactive and engaged, you do it. If it's best to leave things alone and not say anything or do anything, then you leave things alone. But it's not coming from a plan. I think also in the car today that we were having this conversation about how to deal with angry people. what do you do when you meet with this sort of aggression? And I said, well, the only reliable thing is to be mindful. If you've got a plan, you're toast, as they say. I don't know how you'd say that in German.
It's so we understand.
don't have a plan, but trusting in mindfulness. That's, I would say, is the best bet. Again, in former years, Ajahn Sumedho, when he would talk about when he was a student at University of California in Berkeley, late 50s, early 60s, and he said he was very strongly motivated towards pacifism. He'd been in the U.S. Navy in a peacetime period, but he was quite motivated towards pacifism and sort of the anti-war movement that was going on at that time. And then So one of the standard questions when you're having these, you know, at UC Berkeley, there's a lot of discussion and argument and student debate. You say, if you took a stance on pacifism, then this one of the standard questions would be, well, what would you do if a maniac attacked your mother? Would you just sit there and let your mother be attacked? And so he would bring that up to the community in Chittorstha Amravati and be giving reflections on that. He said, I realize now that was an unfair question. In fact, I don't know what I'd do because it hasn't happened. But if it did happen, I trust that I'd be mindful and that I would respond to the situation in an appropriate way. I don't know what I'd do, but I know that that what could be done would be what would arise, and that according to the details of the time, the place, the situation, and what was possible, the nature of the maniac attacking, and why they were attacking his mother in the first place. So I thought that's extremely wise, you know, that we can easily get drawn into these sort of theoretical sort of modes of planning. What should I do? What's the right thing to do? What's the wrong thing to do? And any kind of specificity, like in this situation, you should always do this, or you should never say anything. But as soon as you've got a rigid program, then it's not going to work. That you can be sure of. And that just attuning to the time, the place, the situation, who you're with. And Ajahn Chah was really a master of that. He was completely unpredictable how he would respond to any situation. I couldn't understand Thai at all in the early days. But you could see how somebody would be very, aggressive towards him, or very sort of challenging and confrontational. And you think, well, what's Lung Pho going to do with this? You know, he's going to get this guy to calm down, and he's going to, you know, argue against him or point out how he's got some really wrong ideas. And then you sort of look at him and suddenly realize, oh, he just cracked a joke. And it completely took the sort of contentious energy. He just saw, okay, there's a gap, and cracked a joke and changed the whole energy, the whole atmosphere of the exchange. Or somebody would come along and they'd be incredibly devotional and very sweet and sort of full of admiration, and you think, he'll be flattered or pleased by this person who's obviously being very, very respectful and expressing their devotion towards him. And then he looks straight through them, like there's not even someone there to be invisible. They're just like, oh my goodness, he's like, and you could tell he didn't plan any of it. It was nothing was planned or figured out beforehand. It was all just his attunement to the dynamic of the situation. So and the more that you use that, you apply that principle, and you see the results of it, then it's a cumulative process. You see, oh, that really works. That's something that's a way of relating that can be trusted, and that you are able to just go into situations and work with them as you find them. You don't have to have a plan. I was reminded of last year in December, I had led a week-long retreat in Thailand, and the person who was managing it had never managed a retreat before. And he was a business consultant, and he had an extremely organized life. Everything was sort of listed and sorted and ordered. And so we had to get from the retreat place, which was about 3 or 4 hours drive to Bangkok before midday. So when we only eat in the morning time, so we had to leave after dawn, and have a meal along the way. And so he was really keen to pin down where we were going to have the meal. And I said, well, we're going through Saraburi. It's a huge town. There's bound to be somewhere to eat. He said, but where are we going to eat? where are you? And I said, there's 300,000 people in Saraburi. It's like, there's going to be food available at 9 a.m. somewhere. And so we had a little bit of a back and forth. I tend to be very sort of accommodating as much as possible. But I thought, no, it's like, we don't need to pin it down. Let's just go and see what happens. And eventually it persuaded him to run the risk. And so I didn't want to make him uncomfortable, but I thought, well, really, you know, this is the most sensible option. And looking up the name, the list of restaurants in Saraburi on his phone, you know, see, was not particularly reliable. You know, there was a few places that were listed as being open, and drove by, they weren't open. So we drove a bit through the center part of town. Lo and behold, there's a few noodle shops, and we stopped. And perfectly adequate place to sit down. And about 5 minutes into the mealtime, this very very ordinary little noodle shop where we stopped for the meal, and he said, actually, this place is very good. This food is great. So I restrained myself from saying, told you so. But it wasn't predicted. It wasn't planned. But just that sense of just a little example like that. Just okay. If we find somewhere to eat, then we'll stop. And if we don't find somewhere to eat, well, we just buy some fruit in the market. Something will happen. We'll work it out somehow. So the more that there is a genuine openness and adaptability, and the less we have fixed methodologies and fixed goals, then life is a lot more spacious and peaceful. So I often say adaptability is the key to happiness. If you're a control freak, or you've got fixed and rigid plans, it makes life very, very stressful and tight. So I would suggest, takes a bit of courage to sometimes it's more than just finding the right place to eat. You know, there's bigger things. Should I buy the house, sell the house, move to another country, go into the monastery, leave the monastery? So sometimes there are much bigger questions, but I feel that's learning to trust that attunement to the time, the place, the situation, that's the most reliable source for good decision making.